Dr. Neely to be my guest again tonight to talk about his program at Lemon Creek called Flying University. Welcome, Dr. Neely. It's great to have you back again on the program.
Thank you, Elaine. It's great to be here.
Could you give, because not everybody, of course, was listening to our last program in February. So I'm just so impressed with what you're doing at Lemon Creek. Could you explain what the Flying University is?
Sure. The Flying University is a prison education program I started in fall 2012 that brings university students inside the prison for mutual and collaborative study. And that's a phrase that we take to heart, because when I bring university students inside the prison, we're not there to research the students or the inside students. We're not there to help the inside students. We're there to learn from the students, understanding that they have perspectives on culture and community and trauma that we ought to be listening to. And so that's been working. Every semester I teach a 10 to 12 week seminar. And on a different topic.
Inside the prison,
that's right. And usually we have, I think the ideal seminar, it matches 9 inside students with 9 outside students. So we have about 18 people. And then that program ended up becoming kind of a reentry effort. We were modeled off of a program called Inside Out, prison exchange program that began at a Temple University. And I've been working with Dr. Steve Shankman at the University of Oregon to sort of think about how to develop this program. But what is different between Flying University and all these other programs that have influenced it is that we've become a reentry effort. Mm-hmm. Because Juneau is such a small community. When people get released from Lemon Creek Correctional Center, we know them. They're our neighbors. They're our cousins. They're our friends, our family. And so we just began to muster the resources on campus to help those who were interested in reentering through higher education. And since that has developed, we have developed a Flying University Scholarship Initiative this past semester, which has been really incredible. Yeah, so we're...
For scholarship for when people get out?
Inside and outside, that's right. So we have, the Flying University began by awarding just certificates of completion. And some of those were designated with distinction, and they would go in inmates' files. And if ever I could write a letter of support, I could do so. But about a year ago, we were able to start offering college credit to a few of the guys inside. And so we've offered Writing 111 and Philosophy 201. And that was paid for by the kindness and generosity of community members like Rick Iannolino, KJ, and Peggy Metcalf. They've been really instrumental in building that. But that's not sustainable. I can't go to KJ and Peggy every semester and ask for, scholarship funds. So they, with their generosity, they offered us the seed money to start the scholarship initiative that's now run through the UA Foundation.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh, so University of Alaska is your partner.
That's right.
In this. Oh, that is really terrific. You know, I think that one of the first impressions people might have, there'd be a stereotype that somehow prisoners, people who end up in jail, aren't college material. And since we know that there's a disproportionate number of people of color and a disproportionate number of people who come from poverty, I would think that most of the people in the prison never even dreamed. It wasn't about their academic ability. It was rather they never dreamed they could go to college. They probably grew up with parents who themselves had no higher education. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, Scott Burton of KTOO did a Flying University documentary a few years back, and in it he sort of highlights and portrays the lives of 4 young men who were formerly incarcerated at Lemon Creek and then ended up at UAS. And they all say the same thing. Like, I never thought this was possible. I never thought that college was anything I could do. And 2 of them have, not only have they graduated, but they're now in master's programs.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Oh, I got chills.
Yeah.
It just makes me feel so good.
And another one is about to graduate, I think. But just life circumstances are really difficult. And so I think that's right. People don't know that they can do this. And I think what happens is they get to campus. And what I try to do is I try to show them this, you know, while they're taking our seminar inside the prison. Like, you are totally capable of doing college level classes. And that's why that's what the Flying University is about. It's not just another education program. I love and I respect and all the wonderful education opportunities inside the prison are necessary. But they all serve different niche, you know, populations. And the one I'm serving here is people who are interested in higher education. So the inside students who take the class, they have to have GEDs. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that motivates, you know, if somebody's interested, they hear, University.
They get their GED.
Yeah.
There is a GED program inside the prison?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. It's run by the education coordinators inside Lemon Creek, Paul McCarthy and Chris Weichselman. And they're brilliant. They're real, real good allies of Flying University. They really care deeply for mustering these resources and distributing them to the inmates.
Well, you know, the stereotype that people out of prison may have about the college-going ability of people in prison mm-hmm. could also have been absorbed by the prisoners themselves. In other words, if you grow up poor, if you grow up disadvantaged, mm-hmm. If you grew up without parents who even had the dream of mm-hmm. going to college, and we know people of color and poor people may internalize those views of society that there's something wrong with me, I'm mm-hmm. not good enough. Mm-hmm. And what a amazing experience it would be, because of course not everybody is going to be able to make it in college. We all have different abilities, so it isn't like everybody can go to college. But for those prisoners who do have the raw talent mm-hmm. to be able to make it academically.
Yeah.
I bet you have high school dropouts, a lot of high school dropouts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think when the formerly incarcerated students who've ended up at UAS, I think that they realize that other students who are college bound or who plan to be college bound most of their life, they suffer the same kind of anxiety issues, the same kind of confidence issues, you know. And as a college professor in general, that's what I try to remind my students all the time. I get students that come into my office and they say, "Man, this is really difficult material. I don't know if I can do this. I'm beginning to wonder if I should even be here." Mm-hmm. And I remind them that I have a parade of students every year or every semester that come into my office and say the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. it's just really interesting to me how people just have this fundamental lack of confidence. And I think it has a lot to do with the false expectations of power and strength that we're expected to display. We don't live in a culture and a society that understands what a former colleague and dear friend of mine, George Kuntz, who just recently passed away, but he wrote a brilliant book called The Paradox of Power and Weakness. And he says that because we live in a cynical society, cynicism sees the power of powerfulness and the weakness, and weakness is weak, right? Power is powerful and weakness is weak. Mm-hmm. But we don't understand the paradox of that, because our cynical age doesn't allow us to understand that weakness can be a form of empowerment. You know, that we can, in our moments of humility and our moments of vulnerability, we can muster a paradoxical kind of power. And sort of on the flip side of that as well is the disenfranchised and the dispossessed and the mm-hmm. poor, right? That these are voices that bear rich gifts about our community. Mm-hmm. And that when the poor call out to us, it disturbs our patterns and programs of everyday living.
Sure.
Right? I mean, absolutely. The voice of the poor cry out and it disturbs the status quo.
Yeah.
And we don't listen to it.
Yeah.
We do everything we can to avoid listening to those voices that disturb our status quo. And that's right. Power in that. That's power in that weakness.
Yeah. Yeah. Since you're getting deep, I would like to follow through on that. And tonight, I'd like us to look at really the big picture. What are the societal forces that create in the U.S. mass incarceration? We have way too many people in prison. In fact, we have 2.3 million people locked up in the U.S. and I took a look at the list of per capita, okay, per capita, and shockingly, the U.S. has by far the highest per capita number of people in prison. The closest runner-up is Russia. Now, isn't that a coincidence, okay, given the situation around our current administration and Russia? So authoritarian regimes have high incarceration rates. Then if you take a look at democracies, they jump way down. It's not like there's a normal little curve. It is where we will have three times as many people per capita as as other democracies. So the way I look at it is we've criminalized poverty. We've criminalized addiction, certainly with all the drug sentencing. We're even starting to criminalize homelessness with people being arrested for sleeping in doorways or sleeping on the streets. I just read that a young black person who drops out of school has a 70% chance of being incarcerated. And of course, once we know, once someone has a record, then their saleability in the job market goes way, way down. Not to mention, well, we'll get into that later, just the sheer trauma. As you know, I'm a psychotherapist who has worked my whole career with trauma. In fact, I would say most of the mental health problems, anxiety, depression, you know, the kind of we'll call run-of-the-mill mental health problems, are caused by early trauma in the family usually, but it also could be outside the family as well. And when I think of the experiences that prisoners have in prison, the violence, the dehumanizing aspect, the horror of it. And now that we're going towards private prisons, all the research I've read has said that private prisons are far, far worse than public facilities, as are private mental health hospitals. Okay? And remember, we just privatized API, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And when I read that it was immediately privatized and put in the hands of a shady company, my skin crawled because I just pictured helpless people who are not to blame for their mental illness. That's how they were born in such a facility. And since I've worked a lot with adolescents, that was one of my specialty areas, I have read about the prison system for underage kids and the privatization and the scandal that's coming that is around private prisons. So, you know, with 28% of prisoners deemed to have mental health problems, and that is a huge underestimate, we're criminalizing mental illness. We're putting people in jail who should be in treatment facilities or get outpatient help. So could you, I mean, give some of your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's you're right on all of that. When we're dealing with issues of incarceration, we have to deal with incarceration rates by race and ethnicity, as you pointed out. The effects of incarceration on wealth, the whole system of money bail that we have perpetuates.
Let's talk about that. I only have read a little bit about it. Money bail. Talk about that. What is it?
Well, just when. You know, I mean, when people can't pay the money bail and then they're stuck in pretrial facilities and then that sort of perpetuates the cycles of poverty and jail time. And, you know, thinking about all that collateral, it's part of that sort of collateral consequences that you were getting at as well with regard to incarceration. obstacles such as housing and long-term employment, and then the debt you got to pay off.
It impoverishes you more. Impoverishes your family.
Exactly. But even then, if we look at the statistics of pre-incarceration income and wealth, those are radically diminished as well, right? I mean, it is asymmetrically the poor who get incarcerated and then get stuck in cycles of poverty and anxiety and addiction and all that that you laid out. And thinking about the racial geography of mass incarceration as well, you know, the rural areas in which so many of these prisons are built. You know, there was Michael Moore in his documentary, I think it was Roger and Me, when they closed the GM plant in Flint, Michigan. Mm-hmm. To revitalize that economy, they built a prison. And one of the guys he interviews in that movie says, when they built the prison, half of our community became inmates and half became guards. And the same thing, just as an anecdote, you know, I started teaching in prisons in Indiana while I was finishing up my PhD at Purdue University. And I taught in two prisons, and they were both in rural Indiana. And it was the same scenario. You know, the vast number of guards were white. The vast number of the incarcerated population were people of color, particularly black. And in fact, one of the prisons I taught in there had been run by the KKK. And it was so notorious and so entrenched that the National Guard was sent in to break that up.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you mean run by the KKK?
Well, you know that's what's unique about the state of Indiana, that the KKK ended up sort of entrenching themselves in every aspect of state and municipal governance, and including the prison system.
Given I grew up in Illinois, I should have known that.
Indiana was the KKK achievement for politicized, institutionalized white supremacy. And so, you know, and that's the same. And it was, I tell you, here's an anecdote. It kind of blew my mind. I had to go get a DOC badge one day from one of the prisons in Indiana.
Department of Corrections badge.
Correct.
Here, you mean?
Yes.
Or in Indiana?
In Indiana.
Okay.
And the guard who was filling out the paperwork and giving me my ID, he asked me what my title was, my official title. I said, well, I'm adjunct faculty. How do you spell that? He asked me. And I said, adjunct. And then I spelled. And the inmate he was overseeing, who was helping him, was much more literate. Uh-huh. Because the inmate, who was a person of color, was telling the white guard how to spell adjunct, how to spell faculty, what that means. And the guard is typing F-A-C-U-L-T-Y. You know, I'm telling him how to spell it. And right. I get my badge, and it's got spelled with two L's. You know? And so there's something else going on, right? I mean, and when we think about the racial geography of mass incarceration as well. And then sentencing enhancements, getting busted for drug offenses in school zones disproportionately affects people of color and
so you poverty. Think that I think what you're saying is that you know, rich kids smoke pot and mm-hmm. take drugs in school zones, and poor kids do it. Mm-hmm. And so the police would be patrolling the poor kids area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And you know, when we think about all of the reports that have come out and studies that, I mean, it just seems to me beyond doubt that racial profiling and institutional police practices, you know, carry that bias within them that disproportionately affects people of color.
Well, you know, have you read the author Ta-Nehisi Coates?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, you know, in his book, a slim volume, but I would highly recommend it to anybody, to really get a sense, to start to get a sense of what it's like to be inside a black male body. Mm-hmm. It was a letter he wrote to his son. And after reading that book, it really moved me. And I thought, you know, whether you're rich and, you know, middle class black, whether you're a poor black, when you're a black male, there you are at risk of being arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And you're always having to walk around tense.
Yeah.
'Cause at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were incidents in that book, true incidents, of college-educated black men just getting pulled over.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I, as a white woman, never have I been pulled over. Never. Just, you know, and I certainly have had broken taillights, and I haven't had my registration on my license. And as a matter of fact, I remember speeding on at North Douglas Highway, and I got pulled over, rightly so, because I was speeding, and I was let go. I was given a warning, and I thought, wow.
You know, and you're talking about the root causes of this kind of stuff, and this institution that, you know, this prison industrial complex that we've created and inherited. And when I ask about this with my students, I'll ask the student, you know, I'll say, listen, 1 in 3 black men ages 18 to 24 is caught up in the prison system. Now, you can ask yourself, what is the cause of this? Or you can ask yourself, what is this a symptom of? Mm-hmm. And they're two totally different questions. And they'll produce two totally different results and perspectives. And I think when we focus on causes, the discourse I hear back anyway tends to be a racist, racialized discourse.
Like what do you mean? Like, he's a bad guy. They individualize it.
Exactly.
He's a bad guy.
Exactly. Exactly. They individualize it, and one thing I really want to say real quick, and it's a very important qualification, because when we have these conversations, and I don't know what people are thinking as they're listening to this on the radio, when we offer the critique of the status quo, people get so personally offended. And I want to just remind people that we're dealing with institutional issues. And so that if people can try not to take personal offense at the things that we're talking about and really recognize that we're caught up in institutions and power dynamics and economic relationships, then we can what becomes legible to us critically changes, I think. And so I'm really interested in focusing on what are these symptoms of?
Yeah.
You know, symptoms of 400 years of slavery and colonialism.
Yes.
And then, of course, we know that at the end of the Civil War, the 13th Amendment doesn't abolish slavery. It just moves it into the prison system.
And now that's a big statement you just made.
Mm-hmm.
And let's unpack that one.
Okay.
Okay. Could you explain how it doesn't abolish slavery, it moves it into the prison system?
Yeah. The 13th Amendment says there will be no more prison or no more slavery or indentured servitude in the United States, except for duly convicted criminals.
And then you have a really disproportionate number of black males. The grandchildren of former slaves.
Right, that's right. You know, there was a few decades of Reconstruction, but then when you think about the history of apartheid and Jim Crow laws in the United States, and you think about the viciousness of white supremacy, you know, particularly in the early part of the 20th century, which is dramatized to really profound effect by Toni Morrison's novels, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, when you think about that and the racism that comes with this, I mean, it's no wonder, you know, we have the rise of the prison, what do they call it, the inmate lease program, right? You've got chain gangs, you've got labor, a pool of labor that you can force people to produce and to manufacture and to do all sorts of things and just pay them a pittance, if anything at all. My students who go into the prison with me here, who are living in the college dorms at UAS, wake up every morning and see on their bed made by inmates in Lemon Creek Correctional Center.
What's made? What do they make?
Their beds. The beds in the dormitory at UAS were made in Lemon Creek.
And didn't I see at some time that laundry is done, something like laundry's done in the prison for the state fairies? They do something.
I did hear that, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Yeah. And I think when we think about the prison industrial complex and what is this a symptom of, then specific causes don't get fetishized, right? Because what we can do is we can fetishize particular causes. And then when we fetishize those particular causes, other aspects and influences become illegible to our focus.
What do you mean fetishize?
We just, you know, we sort of shift our origin stories to these particular...
You mean our explanation?
Yeah, our explanations to particular influences and aspects, but we don't look at the broader economic relations. We don't look at the broader history of colonialism. We don't look at the imperatives of capitalism, the manufacturing of desire, you know, all of these things that critical theory wants to bring our focus to.
And I would say at a less lofty view, if we really take a look at the demographics of our prison system, are we really saying that poor people and people of color are inherently more evil, more criminal than white middle-class people living in the suburbs? Because that's what it says.
Yes.
If you take a look at the demography.
That's right. And that's part of the fetish, I think, because we fetishize particular kinds of crimes, like property crimes, which are relatively small compared to the white collar crimes that are being committed all the time in this country. The 2008 financial, you know, crash. I mean, who went to prison on that? You know,
right. And not to mention the crime of the American government of right now in Juliana versus the U.S. Young people are suing the U.S. government for not protecting them from the ravages of climate change.
Right.
So is that criminal or what? It's about the destruction of the whole planet.
Yeah, that's
right. Oil company executives who go on to fund campaigns to stop a carbon tax in Washington state and then greenwash it by having a little bit of solar around. I mean, these are criminal activities. This is genocide. This is beyond the pale.
Yeah,
but
that's
I got it.
That's right. And that's the problem with, I think, that's why I'm a little bit allergic to the vocabulary of cause, because it's so focused on origins. And when we look at, I mean, listen, guys inside prison, people who are incarcerated in our prison, they might be guilty of the particular crimes they committed, whatever that might be.
Of course.
Violence, domestic assault, theft, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But they're not necessarily the origin of violence in our broader community. I mean, speaking more broadly, right? Now, and that's where we have to look at symptoms. What are the long history of economic relationships? What has capitalism done to our environment, to our community? What kind of morality are we articulating and defending?
Well, particularly neoliberal capitalism, that is our most current form, we see homeless people all over. And I don't know if you've read a book called The Library Book, but I was just at the Northwoods Writers Conference, and it's a New York Times bestseller, and the author was in Skagway at the Writers Conference. And so I just finished reading the book, and it's really everything you always wanted to know about libraries in America, which doesn't sound very interesting. But one of the things that really struck me, because I brought my granddaughter to the library today, are all the homeless people that are in the library. Now, I admit, you know, there are a lot of cruise ship passengers, but if you go most of the year, it's homeless people in the library. And the book talked about how it was at a certain point in time when, you know, we started getting changes in economic policy that coincided with vast numbers of people being deinstitutionalized, closing institutions, mental health institutions, cutting the safety net of services, and you all of a sudden got a lot of people on the streets. And so that is a function of economic policy. They weren't there before, and now they're here. And now the increase is phenomenal. And this is a very interesting, you know, thing of what is the explanation for that. Well, we're so mesmerized by the idea of fear.
Yes.
Okay. The fear of the homeless. And so rather than think, where did these guys come from? Where did these people come from? You know, why are there so many homeless? Well, in libraries, they never had to deal with homeless until I forget what year, you know, 1990 or something. Okay, it was because there weren't that many homeless that were hanging out in the library. So what was interesting is libraries started becoming more like community centers, warming shelters, taking up the slack for services that no longer existed because they were no longer funded.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you put your finger on it. I mean, fear. It dominates it is the fundamental characteristic of our political moment and our political climate. And I think that fear is buttressed by a cynicism. You know, this is why I love Cornel West, who says the enabling virtue for any philosopher is courage. Courage to think, courage to hope, courage to love. FDR was right to say the only thing to fear is fear itself.
Yeah.
But here in Alaska, we passed SB 91. It really did not have time to go into effect as it was intended to go into effect. Other states have put it into full implementation, and it has worked. But we immediately stoked this fear and worked it back. You know, HB 49.
Well, I'm very struck by how our most recent presidential campaign and the most recent gubernatorial campaign, the winning candidates both emphasized fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to rouse people's anxiety. For Trump, it was the fear of the other, the other now being Mexican-American. And though it constantly was shown that what he was saying about the hordes of Mexicans crossing the border were blatantly false.
Right.
They were a lie.
Yeah.
And how the current administration is playing on when the current governor was running for running in the election, he too was doing having what was it, town meetings for so people could talk about how afraid they were and how horrible crime had increased in Alaska. I mean, that's a cheap shot.
Yeah.
I mean, the Third Reich, the Nazis did the same thing.
Yeah.
Homosexuals, Jews, they were the communists. They were the bad guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the worst part about that whole discourse and the talking points that go out around that political effort to scale back SB 91. Is this insistence, this sort of discursive insistence that we separate victims from perpetrators. And, you know, I was testifying this legislative session in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I hear people calling in from around the state saying things like, people who support SB 91 don't care about the victims. And my response is, no, we do care about victims. But we also understand that the divide between victims and perpetrators is not as clear-cut as we wish it would be. Because, in fact, we're talking about symptoms earlier. A lot of these people who end up in prison are themselves victims of a system, an economic system, a colonial system, right?
Exactly. And, exactly. So I think we should take a break because this is pretty heady stuff. And let's give it some time to sink in. So what we're going to do now is take a short musical break, and then Dr. Saul Neely and I will be back to talk some more about the current state of incarceration in the U.S. and the possibility of reimagining how we see justice. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Dr. Saul Neely, who's a professor of English at University of Alaska Southeast and who founded the Flying University at Lemon Creek Prison. We have just been talking about the root causes of crime and violence, and we will continue doing so because I was struck by my own field, and what we realize is the lots of research has been done on risk of mental illness, risk of substance abuse, risk of addiction, and the finger points at poverty. Mm-hmm. Okay, and let's admit the connection between racism and poverty go hand in hand. So there's a very similar root cause, a model. It isn't that rich people cannot suffer from mental health problems, but when there's a disproportionate number way over the group that has grown up middle class or wealthy. Mm-hmm. The stress of poverty is enormous. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of this is a kind of a poignant anecdote. We adopted a 13-year-old Vietnamese refugee many, many years ago, a lovely boy that many people know here in Juneau. And he did have biological parents. We only found this out later. Of course he had biological parents, but they were alive. We didn't know that until we had done an investigation. The father had been an officer in the South Vietnamese Army, and with the liberation of Vietnam, he was jailed. He was put in prison, and the system was to force his family to feed him in prison. In other words, everything he got in prison was supplied by the family. This was purposely done to impoverish the family. Mm. But the other thing was the prison was so harsh that he lost his mind and died very early. And what that brings to mind for me is the conditions of the prison system. So it is the double whammy. Not only are poor people more likely, and people of color more likely to go to jail, but they are more likely to be abused in jail. Now, you may say, well, this is meant to be punishment. I mean, what's the deal? It's meant to hurt. It's not meant to be inhumane. Mm-hmm. Because what happens if we treat people in a way that denigrates their humanity? Mm-hmm. They come out greatly disturbed. I mentioned how from what I know about solitary confinement, I consider it torture because it creates
So does the UN,
and the UN considers it torture, and it creates mental illness. So my question is, what do we want? We have a prison in Juneau, so don't we want the prisoners who are released after they serve their time to be healthy, functioning members of society? Well, if we do, which of course we do, we don't want to harm them in prison. We want to rehabilitate them. Mm-hmm.
You just laid out a whole bunch of really important intersecting concerns there, I think. And I'm just going to remind people, too, that I approach this as sort of an interdisciplinary philosopher. So I'm not an economist, but in the field of critical theory, we think very seriously about economy. And so when you talk about economy, we also have to talk about resource distribution and going back to the point you made earlier about the library and the social spaces that we have. Why are these social spaces under attack, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that they really intersect. Well, for one, we need to remind people every chance we get that the budget crisis and the fiscal crisis is manufactured.
Yes.
Doesn't really exist. There's no shortage of money in this community, in this state, in this nation, in this world. It's just concentrated into the hands of a few people, and that is by design. That is not inevitable.
Exactly.
That is by design.
And economists have proven this. Piketty, Thomas Piketty, famous economist, came out with a book called Capitalism, as a matter of fact, several years ago. And he was in The Economist and, you know, reviewed all over the place, and in which he showed that poverty is structurally developed by government policy.
Exactly. And, you know, especially when politicians are out campaigning, they love to denigrate socialism, and you can go all over social media and see people denigrate socialism, but nobody ever talks about the horrors of capitalism. And, you know, this is one of the, my favorite texts to teach is, it's the section from George Orwell's 1984. It's called The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism. And in that statement, it is revealed that the fundamental problem with economy is not scarcity, it's surplus. But yet we're taught, our whole discourse about economy is around scarcity. We don't have enough, we don't have enough, we don't have enough. Well, no, that's not the case. The case is, what do we do with the surplus that our economy generates? And this is where the by design comes into, right? The ruling capitalist class does not want that money reinvested back into our communities to lift the standard of living. Right, they want to burn that surplus wealth off. And how do we? What's the best way to burn off that surplus wealth? It's through perpetual fear, perpetual scapegoating, perpetual war. Right, this is why we can burn off money and get people psychologically invested in the destruction of that wealth. And so, I think we need to rethink the horrors of capitalism. We need to reimagine social democracy along the ways of Norway and the other social democracies.
Countries, if I may add, that have a much higher level of happiness. So lots of research has been done on which countries are the happiest. And I remember reading an ARP. Those over 62 know what ARP is. It's this American Association of Retired People magazine. And they were interviewing people. It was sort of a cool article. They were interviewing people from around the world. And I remember this one vignette of a doctor from Norway who was being interviewed about what's it like to retire in Norway. And it said, well, you know, I don't make as much as American doctors by a long shot. You know, I make $95,000 a year, whereas people in my specialty in America would make $300,000 or $500,000 a year. But I'll tell you the truth. I could care less because everything's – I mean, I don't have to worry. I don't have to have a bank account of millions of dollars because I'm afraid that I'll get dementia and I can't afford a place to stay. I don't have to worry about that. I have a government-supported retirement. All is well. And research has shown that security is what one of the factors that brings happiness. So in our system, we're constantly insecure. I've got three kids, who one of whom has excellent insurance, health insurance, because he works for the state of Washington. The other has so-so health insurance because she works for the state of Alaska, which has much poorer health insurance than Washington State. And their level of insecurity, the one who works for the state of Alaska, there's such a high deductible that she doesn't go see the doctor. And that, you know, so insecurity, fear creates unhappiness. We're the idea, I think people, most people, it isn't like I want to be rich. They really want to be happy. But there's the belief that if I have a whole lot of stuff, I'm going to be happy. And all the research shows that once you have a job, health insurance, a car, and a house or a place to live, you gain no more happiness by being richer than that. But it's the lie that's fed to us.
It's the lie that it's fed to us. And I also think it's the, you know, this is going back to George Kuntz, who I mentioned at the beginning of the interview. He talks about three expressions of cynicism. And one is criticism of others, that sort of scapegoating, the stuff you see on social media where people just are cruel to one another, right? That kind of constant criticism of others. Two, manipulation of the system for one's own self-gain, right? And we got to be honest about that, right? I mean, how is the status quo, as awful as it is, manipulated by vested interests? You know, I mean, so, and I'm not talking about just like the GEO Corporation, one of the big for-profit prison companies. I'm talking about people in our community. I mean, we got to think about that too. If we're thinking about fundamentally restructuring community so that we can dramatically reduce our prison industrial complex, well, what are the guards going to do? What are the prison administrators going to do?
What direction are we going now in the U.S. and in the state of Alaska concerning privatization of prisons?
Well, you know, I need to update my research on this, but the border crisis that's been sort of manufactured under the Trump administration, you know, a lot of that stuff is fed by for-profit prison.
Of course, these concentration camps that they're putting people in.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, our current governor wants to bring all of that back. It hasn't worked. It doesn't work. I don't understand why.
You mean bring privatization back, or sending our prisoners down south to private prisons? I don't understand how budget cutting, saving money, and then it seems like the contradiction of the current administration of wanting to build or increase the prison population by rescinding the criminal justice reform legislation.
Yeah, and this is where I think we have to be sober and vigilant when we say follow the money. I mean, look at the governor's primary budget director, Donna Arduin.
Yeah.
What is her history? Who is she? And what has she done in other states?
Well, tell me, what has she done?
This is her job to go across various states like Kansas and elsewhere. Kansas is one of the most notorious ones, and to institute these draconian budget cuts that are completely in line with national political
agendas.
That systematically defund and destabilize our economies and our communities and our social spaces. And then bring over those savings and those tax credits to the super wealthy. This is why between 1983 and 2013, the wealth over those 30 years, actually it's 1989 to 2016, I was just looking at these statistics today, how the wealth has just radically moved into the hands of the few. And it's because of these economic policies that Donna Arduin has brought into our state. So this is not Alaska. This is not homegrown.
No, not at all.
Not even remotely. This is national political agendas that have made their way into Alaska, just like they've made their way into so many other states. And they appear as if they're grassroots, but they're not grassroots.
Well, not if you have to create your own rally.
Right.
In the Mat-Su to support a full dividend. I thought that was pretty obvious. It just was so Trumpian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we're gonna create a rally. If there was a rally and nobody showed up, you'd say that a lot of people were there. But since rallies are supposed to be spontaneous events by people, by the citizens, for the governor to create a rally is an oxymoron. I mean, it's very bizarre.
Yeah.
And it really has you feel like we're in an alternative reality here.
And why aren't support privatized prisons? Because there's dark money.
Yeah.
Right? That's sourcing that political agenda. And we have to expose it.
We have a few minutes to really take a look at what needs to be done. And on our last show, we talked about the Norwegian prison system and prisons in Germany, Norway, the Netherlands. They have a completely different model. And as I understand it, the model is to really take a look at the path that a person, an incarcerated person, needs to take in order to not commit a particular crime again. I mean, obviously, that's our goal.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal has to be rehabilitation because, as we talked about earlier, so-called punishment is really making the person more disturbed when they leave the prison than when they went in.
Mm-hmm.
So why would we want that?
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't we want to encourage human dignity and rehabilitation? And these prison systems in Northern Europe are radically different from our own. Just one thing I noticed in an article I was reading is the lack of density. In other words, our prisons are overcrowded. And we know from animal as well as human studies that overcrowding creates violence. Mm-hmm. It just does. Mm-hmm. Okay, no exit. You're in this small space with a whole lot of people. And I think most of us would get testy. The other day, I was in an airplane that had to sit on the tarmac for 2.5 hours. And we were crowded. Mm. Every seat was taken. And I just thought, oh, please, let's take off. Because I could just feel the tension rising in the plane. No water, no food. Mm-hmm. It was hot. So their density in the same space, and this is a statistic from Germany, where we'll have 1,300 people in a particular space, that same amount of space in a German prison would have 300 people. Mm. So they also emphasize the principle of normalcy, the need for the prison as much as possible to mimic the community, because they want people to be able to leave that prison and go out into the community, with the very important difference. The people in prison are not free. Mm-hmm. And that, if you want to call it a punishment, that's the biggest punishment of all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, the prison system began, the modern prison system began as a humane prison reform, or a humane response to the spectacle of the scaffold. This is all sort of detailed really well, I think, in Michel Foucault's book, Discipline and Punish. And I'll talk about the first prison in the United States as a penitentiary. It was where the Quakers wanted to put people in an isolated cell so they could deal with their conscience and God, mm-hmm. right? But that becomes...
Rather than have capital punishment, the
right,
gallows.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. But that becomes torture. That becomes revenge. So it begins as a sort of positive, well-intended attempt at reform.
In America.
In America. Yeah. And then it becomes something awful. And, you know, Louis Althusser, the great sort of Lacanian Marxist, said, ideology has no history. And he didn't mean that ideology has no history. He means it acts as if it has no history. That's how ideology worked. It seems so natural. So to us today, the prison system just seems so natural.
Yeah.
What do you do in a society to punish people in a society that values a particular kind of liberty that we have? Well, you take that away and you institute retribution and revenge as opposed to rehabilitation. And I think I mentioned this last time we talked together. How do you rehabilitate somebody who's never been habilitated?
Yeah.
What about people who come from such awful adverse childhood experiences and such awful transgenerational trauma that there's no habilitation in the first place? They get habilitated through the prison system. And so we have to radically imagine otherwise than what we have. And
you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Right.
Because that movie that former Commissioner of Corrections, Dean Williams, was showing all around the state mm-hmm. was about the Norwegian system. Statistically, it is a winner. Mm-hmm. The recidivism rate, which means the percentage of people who return to jail because they've committed a crime, mm-hmm. Is way low compared to America. So all the data shows, the science shows, mm-hmm. that exactly. rehabilitation works. Harsh punishment creates more crime.
Yeah.
And so in that movie, we saw the humane approach. It was, to us, revolutionary mm-hmm. because they compared it to a typical American prison. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also think of what it does to the guards
yeah.
and all the people working in prison. To be in that harsh atmosphere, mm-hmm. It would be very traumatic as a guard. I mean, I remember when I was working briefly at the juvenile prison facility in Seattle when I was in graduate school, working in the girls' unit, and I would go in there and get a headache. And I never get headaches because the situation was so tense.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have a model, and we need to work towards that model. Texas has worked towards it. There's other states mm-hmm. in the U.S. who are working on a rehabilitative model, and that's mm-hmm. where we need to go.
Yeah, it's the film's called Breaking the Cycle.
Yes, and can you get it on YouTube?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's end on that positive note because I am so grateful to you, Saul, for coming this evening. And I want to thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom about the criminal justice system and the prison system. And I want to thank you for your compassion and hard work that you have been of great benefit to many, many otherwise marginalized people in and out of prison. And I really want to thank Shelley Delaney for her technical work and for producing tonight's show.
Yeah,
so please, to our audience, tune in next month on another Monday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Mind Over Matter. Good evening.
Its main border crossing with Colombia, but it is still difficult for international agencies to bring in desperately needed food and medicine, so local charities have stepped up to help the country's needy.
No public organization or international organization are taking care about of them.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. More from Venezuela on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is KTOO Juno. It's just about 8 o'clock. Up next, Bioneers.